Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. You can listen and subscribe to the show for free on Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Blog Talk Radio, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. For network or show information, visit ByteRadio.me. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Dr. Laura Gabayan, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Common Wisdom. Common Wisdom is a fascinating and enlightening exploration describing the 8 scientifically derived elements of wisdom that will profoundly change lives. The author, Dr. Gabayan, is a world-renowned physician researcher who extensively interviewed 60 wise individuals who responded to a series of questions about their thoughts on wisdom in their lives. Their responses were meticulously reviewed and utilizing actual scientific methodology, arrived at 8 common elements shared among these fascinating people. Dr. Laura Gabayan is, a world-renowned physician and researcher regarded internationally as an expert in the field of emergency medicine. She has received multiple research grants and awards for her work. Dr. Gabayan has also published dozens of papers cited by hundreds of researchers. She has now applied her scientific expertise to the study of the concept of wisdom. This discovery resulted in the first of its kind multi-year research effort dubbed the Wisdom Project. For more information, you can visit her website, which is lauragabayan.com, and that's lauragabayan.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Laura to the show. Good day. Thanks for joining me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure, and I enjoyed reading your book. It was an easy read. I like books, you know, that break things down to its very basic components. So I'm really looking forward to talking about the book. Now, I read that in 2013 that you were diagnosed with an autoimmune condition, and that maybe impacted your view of traditional medicine and other types of healing. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, that particular period and, you know, what effect it had on your views?
Well, I was very, very type A, very into it. This is what I learned in med school. This is this, is that, not very spiritual. And then I find out that something that had this health challenge, and ends up being wrong, but I was really taken aback as to how people didn't really think outside the box. In a way, having the education was a curse, because people were sticking to facts. And that's when I realized, though, the people who don't, who do think outside the box, who do have a wider lens, are the wise. And that's when I started to think about studying wisdom. And to study wisdom, it's a whole process, because to study anything, it's a whole process. But you have to learn about what was done before, you have to create the project, you have to, and I wanted to define it objectively. So I think it was really an awakening. An opportunity to learn more about something else.
Yeah, now, I mean, typically I would think wouldn't the general understanding of the idea of wisdom being able to be scientifically, you know, examined, it would seem like that is one of those areas of that might be hard to quantify and actually, you know, put into detail. So did you find that that was a, did you find any resistance to the idea that it could be measured scientifically?
Well, I mean, I think, it came down to my, I was not happy with the anecdotal thoughts of what wisdom was. You know, a lot of the religious texts said, I think it's this or that, or people said it's this or that, or it was very subjective. So in terms of resistance, no, not really. I think the fact that I just did it on my own, I knew how to do research. I published a lot in academia and research as well, so I knew how to do it. And I really didn't run it by anyone, because no one would have, like, if you think about it, it's a combination of the scientific world and the woo-woo world, and you really don't have someone who has the ability to do both, you know?
Yeah, the two, they're intersecting more now, but for quite a long period of time, you know, the two were very distinct. I read in your book that, as far back as Aristotle and Plato, his teacher, that they argued about the definition of wisdom. So obviously it's been a long, turn kind of, you know, back and forth about what is wisdom. So what, you know, through your research, have you been able to maybe provide a particular definition that you feel comfortable with about what wisdom is?
Well, one thing I have realized is it's not, first of all, I didn't know what wisdom was to begin with. And it's not, one thing I realized is it's not what you, oh, that person's wise. Oh, that, I see it when I know it. It's not that. And I do believe that it's a combination of the eight elements I found. So, I think they're all related, and I do think they're all, like, they're connected. But I do believe that it's a combination, and one person may have a lot of one versus not a lot of the other. So do I think that is just one thing? No. I mean, as I said, there's only one person in my whole study of 60 wise people that had all eight elements. One person. So it really isn't a combination. It isn't all of them. And that one person teaches wisdom to people who are above the age of 60, something he does.
Yeah. So now, one of the things I read in the book is that you indicated that multiple studies found wisdom had an inverse U relationship with age. You know, kind of goes up, and then, as you know, at a certain point in age, it kind of goes down. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I never really thought about the backside of the U, you know, with the older age is happening.
Well, I think what they found was that obviously having life experiences gives you the wisdom. But also, once you get a lot older, and that's why I limited my study to people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. But so once they're in their ages, 80s and 90s, there's a greater likelihood that they're not as flexible, that they're more set in their ways. And so that may, if you look at the definition of all eight elements, it actually prevents that. So it makes sense in that regard.
Yeah, that does. Yeah, and now you mentioned, I mentioned in the introduction that you interviewed 60 people, and they were ages 50 to 79. So how did you determine, you know, the individuals, you know, first, you know, that they were wise, you know, and then how did you select the group?
It's to make a study not biased. The researcher, scientist, has to have no arm, no hand, nothing to do with who the people are. And I didn't. And so I essentially told every single person I knew And we posted it on social media as well, Nextdoor, Reddit, all the things. We just put everywhere, who do you know that is wise? And people would nominate someone. And people were very open to talking to me. And those people nominated someone else. And so continued. And it was about a 15 to 20 to 30 minute conversation. I did not know any of them. Now, how did I decide on the number 60? So whenever you do this type of research, you're supposed to stop when you hear the same thing over and over again. And we did. Mm-hmm. We found, I heard a lot of the same things over, even though these people had nothing to do with each other. They did not know one another. And they said similar things. So I would probably say in my, like, around interviewing 20 people, I heard the same thing. So being a scientist, being used to publishing in, you know, there's two kinds of research, qualitative and quantitative. Quantitative is looking at the numbers. And being used to looking at higher numbers, you know, I was not okay with just sticking to a lower number. So I wanted to rehear the same idea over and over again, and I did, and hence number 60.
Yeah, so now, you mentioned, quantitative, so do you feel that, because, once you've got to that number and you're hearing things repetitively, that if the sample were larger, that you would still continue to have the same kind of similar responses?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I heard the same things like three times over. Once I was in my around 20 interviews, and so I heard it over and over and over again. And people just, it was similar in what they had to say and how they approached life and how they thought.
Yeah. Okay. When it comes time to, the eight elements, which we're going to talk about shortly, in your book you indicate just knowing the elements isn't enough, but it's important the using and integrating them into daily life. So can you talk a little bit about, that aspect? You're doing the research, so how, common was it that the people integrated these elements into their lives?
So I think I never asked them. But for example, when I did the research, I was confused. I'm not confused, shocked by the kindness being the second element. And the funny thing is my husband is very kind. And I thought about it, I'm like, well, knowing these eight is not enough because I need to know how to incorporate more kindness more on a regular basis. And does it mean that I become a kinder person? No, overnight I won't. But it does mean that I'm aware of it and I can change certain behaviors and things that I say. And so before I say something, wherever it may be, I think twice. And kindness, for example, goes a long way. Something really small can be kind. And it doesn't take a lot of effort. So that's why I feel like it's important to not only know them, but try to act them or practice doing them. Or positivity. I think if something happens and it's since he was, oh my gosh, for example, let's say it's a car accident. You can think in, the positive. It could have been the worst. It could have been, I could have been more hurt. I can this, that. Or you can think in negative. But I think being more positive about it will feel better, but it's also, it'll be a practice that you'll entertain.
Yeah. Now, when you were talking about kindness, the first thing that popped into my head is the idea of random acts of kindness, which is spoken about. And it seems that exhibiting kindness just, you know, for no other reason, just because, you know, takes, seems to carry a heavier kind of meaning, or it seems to be more significant than kindness that is maybe just a response, you know, almost like a, you know, take kind of response to maybe someone else's kindness.
I think it varies. I think, well, so we did ask the interviewees, why were you nominated for this project? Why do you think you were? And a lot of people said, oh, it's because I devote this, you know, I devote time volunteering doing this, or I have a nonprofit, or whatever it was. They exuded some acts of kindness towards a bigger population. But at the same time, what we found was, in order to do that, people have to be kind towards themselves. And and some actually penciled it in to their day. It was part of their day that they, you know, required that they take a certain amount of time and work kind to themselves, whether it was through meditation or a break or whatever it was their time for themselves. And that allowed them to be kind to others. So it was interesting because it was a combination of how you treat yourself and how you treat others.
Yeah, very interesting. So now, in that idea of applying what you learned, in your book, you also, at the end of each of the eight elements, you have, you know, a few pages of questions under the title Things to Ask Yourself. So were those questions in that? I mean, obviously, and I love that part because, you know, I think, you know, knowledge without application is just, it's just knowledge. I mean, it doesn't really make a whole bit of difference, you know, to anyone else other than yourself and your knowledge base. But can you tell us, you know, why you put that in there? And, you know, were some of the questions that you list, some of the questions you asked of your research participants?
They were not, but they are of the chapter. And they're kind of a perspective of that topic in the chapter. And the reason I feel like it's really important to ask yourselves those questions is because it changes. Like spirituality, for example, when you're in your 20s, you may not really think about a bigger entity. When you're in your 50s, you will. So it changes with time. And so the questions I have also have a different, they have two different options of times or dates to put in because your answers will change. And your perspective of wisdom will change. So that's why I put it in there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, like I said, I think that's a very practical kind of way to apply what people have learned. Now, one of the other questions I had is that, you know, when it came time to learning about wisdom, and were there any other variables that were noticeable, like, for example, gender? Were, you know, females or males more likely, you know, did you kind of get more of one over the other, or race, or even political affiliation kind of thing?
Research has found that there's no relationship between gender, political affiliation, and having wisdom. And the only thing that does have an association is the type of area that a person is from. So that's why it's sex in North America. But I initially was trying to assess, you know, gender and are they from Asia or are they, I try to personalize, you know what, they're either in the U.S. or Canada, they're North American, they speak my language because I speak English, or they don't. And because it would be biased to have someone do this project that required a translator. Anyway, mm-hmm. So I think because then their answers could vary depending on the translator, and I didn't want to introduce any bias. I wanted it to be as unbiased as it could be. So no, the research is not found. And when we did our study, we had people from all over. All over races, all over genders, all over everything. And no, we did not ask them about their politics or their religious affiliations or any of that, because I did not feel like wisdom really is influenced by that. It shouldn't be if yeah. someone feels like someone is wise, and we didn't see that they were.
And do you feel that that the view of an individual's view of what wisdom is subjective? I mean, you know, what I find as someone as being wise may differ from someone else's view of what a wise person is. So does the view of a wise person depend really much on the, you know, the individual's view of them?
It could be, but that's why I wanted to speak with 60 people to kind of take that subjectivity out to see if I could hear the same things, and I did. So it could be subjective, and I think when you think about a specific element, it could be, but I think overall, I think if you're looking at what we found and looking at all the people we talked to, it was not because, you know, we heard the same things over and over again.
Okay. So, you know, and you know, I can see where that consistent or that repetitive nature of the elements would play into someone's view of a wise person. So, we're about halfway through the show. I'm going to take just a quick 90-second break. And then when we come back, I want to kind of delve into the eight elements and talk a little bit more about them, okay?
Okay.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder, we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to the more than 1,700 shows we have aired during the past 13 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, photography products and services, calendars and greeting cards. There is also a link to our account at Fine Art America, where you can purchase items such as mugs, prints, pillows, and more. Our show is available as a free podcast on multiple platforms such as iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts, and Audible, with icons to each platform on our homepage. We are also available on social media platforms such as Facebook, X, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Threads. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my special guest is Dr. Laura Gabayan, and we are talking about her brand new book, Common Wisdom. And you can find out more about Dr. Laura and her book by visiting her website, which is lauragabayan.com, and that's LauraGabayan.com. Okay, with that, we're back. Dr. Laura?
Hi.
Okay, great. So to give the listeners an idea of the different, you know, elements that you identified, you know, for wisdom, and give them an idea of kind of what's contained in the book, I thought we would kind of go through each one, and maybe, you know, you can tell us, you know, the, how it was determined, how that particular element, you know, manifested in some of your participants. And then at the back of each of your chapters on the elements, you also have takeaways. And those are things that people can, you know, keep in mind, you know, when it comes time to, adding these elements or strengthening these elements in their life. So the first one is resilience. So can you tell us, you know, how that was kind of identified and manifested in some of the participants?
So I will start by saying that I am a scientist. I'm a researcher that's published a lot, and in scientific publications, I do have to be very concise and to the point. So that's what you'll find with the book and my description of everything, is that what someone may write in a paragraph, I mean, I'll write in a sentence. The idea of resilience is things don't happen to you, but they happen for you. And the idea is that you don't, you may not know what the bigger picture is, but there is a bigger picture. And that with resilience, it's the idea of not thinking, why me, but why not me? And thinking that I can do it, and that it's a sense of the self-confidence that you can do whatever it is that happens. So resilience, what we saw were people really did encounter a lot of horrible life events, and they overcame them. So, and they went through them, and they, it's funny because one person didn't even talk about overcoming it when we mentioned the event and say, oh yeah, when I have cancer. So I feel like it's something that they kind of viewed as part of life. You don't give up, you just continue.
Yeah, and one of the things that you talked about in that particular element were four keys: acceptance, gratitude, taking it head on, and release worry. And you know, I thought that, you know, I mean, when I was looking at that, it, you know, I kind of did my little reflection on, you know, where I stand, you know, in, you know, each of those keys. And it was interesting. I think that when the reader, you know, goes through your book, that they're going to be spending a good deal of time in reflection.
And, you know, the four steps that you mentioned were a combination of what people, of how people approach difficulties in their life. And so, and yes, acceptance was a big one, and approaching it head on was also a big one. And as I mentioned, the four elements or the four steps were a way that they looked at them, but it wasn't just one person's way. It was many people's way of addressing an issue.
Yeah, yeah. And then you also mentioned in that particular area that people who were resilient tended to view themselves as a warrior versus a victim, which is a real big difference in approaching life.
I think back to the idea of being a victim versus a warrior is big. And I think someone may have lived a large part of their life as a victim, And it's okay. It's never too late to kind of change that over to being a warrior. And it's never too late because you can always change the way you think. And you can always realize I'm more important than whatever has happened in my life. And I will overcome this.
And one of the things is that you mentioned that there was really only one person that exhibited the eight elements. So when someone is, you know, going through, reading the book, going through and learning about the elements and thinking, well, I'm resilient, I'm doing good at that. And then they look at another one thinking, well, I could use some, strengthening of this particular element. When someone is trying to apply those elements, should one be looking at strengthening the weaker elements to kind of, bring a more balanced kind of approach to living, or should it just be keeping in mind each of the elements and working on them simultaneously, I guess, whenever you can?
I think strengthening the weaker one is great because, as I said, I feel like they're all related. And so when you realize, oh, I'm not a very spiritual person, how can I strengthen that? And I think that can help you understand that you can be more creative, you can be more curious because you are more spiritual. So I think it can, in a weird way, strengthening one can help build the others as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. You had mentioned the interconnectedness of them. And I can see where, one kind of event in one's life could touch on multiple elements, Now, kindness was the second element, and you mentioned it earlier about kindness, and that one of the takeaways from that was being kind starts with being kind to yourself, and then you mentioned people even scheduled time for that. But also in that particular chapter, you indicated that forgiveness can be a key to unlocking kindness. So can you talk a little bit about how that fits into that particular forgiveness fits into that element?
So I think with kindness, for example, even when I would look at forgiveness, I'm like, oh, how could you forgive someone for doing something so horrible? How could you be okay with it? But it's really allowing yourself to heal. If forgiveness is more about you than it is about them. And in many ways, the forgiveness is kind of acknowledging that it was bad, but saying it was so bad and I'm not going to let it change my life. I'm not going to let it make me weaker. I'm going to, so yes, kindness, being forgiving is in a way a part of kindness in that it's kindness to yourself. And going back to kindness, I think the idea of kindness, as you said, yes, definitely starts with being kind to yourself. It also is the idea that it's also simple. It's a simple act, and it takes practice. Don't get me wrong. It'll take you thinking twice about what you say and do. But it's simple. It's not something onerous and hard to do. And also kindness, it's a sign of strength. And it's a sign of being the bigger person. As you would, some people would say, is that being kind, and it doesn't mean you're not firm or effective, or you can't be firm or effective, but it does mean that you have a sense of respect for another human being, and you're kind about it.
Yeah, that's, I have a friend who, will quite often, when entering a grocery store where they have the automatic doors, you know, where you kind of step on in front, or even the, you know, that they'll, you know, they'll maybe see some, you know, elderly person coming up and say, just jump ahead of them and say, let me get that for you. You know, recognizing, you know, that it's an automatic thing, that people just laugh. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, immediately kind of brightens someone's day. And to me, yeah. when I first saw that, I thought, that is just silly. You know what I mean? You know, why are you even doing that? Until I kept seeing consistently that people were, they laughed a lot with that. And the same person recently had a health issue and would be started using those electric carts in the, you know, in the grocery store, you know, where you, right. you know, people have. And after the first time, he told me, he says, you know what? People are so much nicer when I'm sitting in the cart, you know. And I just thought that that was interesting, you know, that that the people who may not be overtly kind, you know, to just strangers, would tend to be kinder, you know, to someone who's, you know, experiencing a little bit of a challenge or having to use a cart, you know, like the cart.
I've seen that happen a lot, and I think that's just a reminder that, you know, if someone has anything wrong and you're helping them out, it's more of an extreme of them, you know, needing your help. But the idea of kindness is once you practice it over and over again, it'll get to a point that you don't need to do it just for someone that really needs your help. You can do it for anyone.
Yeah, I agree. And it becomes a more of an automatic response. I mean, unconscious kindness, I guess, in a way, in that it's
right.
just an automatic do that, yeah. Now, one of the other elements, the third of the elements in the eight, was positivity. And I think you mentioned it earlier about, you know, the importance in that car accident of being able to shift one's perspective to a positive, set of circumstances. So can you talk about a little bit about positivity as an element?
Yes, so I think with positivity is, you know, first of all, we all should accept that things will happen in life. It's not if, it's when. They will. And the reaction you have is your choice. And how positive you are is your choice. And knowing that, you know what, I will do my best and things will work out whatever way they will, is very comforting. And also, it's also comforting to know that, you know, you're going to try your best to also take a positive perspective. So when I say it takes practice, like kindness, it takes practice. Just thinking that things can always be worse, and thinking of a few, you know, practice it once a day, practice it twice a day, a few things that could have gone worse or could have been
mm-hmm.
worse will make you feel more positive.
Yeah. Now, I had one of the best teachers in negativity in my mother, you know, as far as, I mean, she truly found it very difficult to look at the, you know, glass half full. And so, you know, in retrospect, you know, I think that that particular training is what led me to, you know, the work that I'm doing now, focusing on positivity. And so, it seems that, you know, if one has like negative thoughts kind of going through the mind, that being able to maybe take a break and switch it, you know, from a negative from what that negative thought is to a positive alternative, that particular switch can, if it's done over time, can then, rewire the brain to basically default into a positive rather than a negative. Would I be right in thinking that?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I too have a negative experience with his mother, and I think in a weird way it makes you look at the positive because you have no choice. You have someone who's reminding you of the negative. And so yes, and I do think you can think of it as rewiring the brain as well. But as I said before, it's practice. It's knowing that things can be worse.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Now, another in the elements of spirituality, you mentioned it a little bit earlier. And so, when you talk about spirituality, it's how does that differ from religion? What is your perspective of what the essence of spirituality is?
So first of all, spirituality, just because we don't see it does not mean it does not exist. And I want people to think about that. And as a scientist, I didn't even think about spirituality early on. I just didn't think about it. I didn't know how to think about it. I didn't know what to think. And now I more and more pay attention to it. And I feel like it takes, like it's part of our lives on a regular basis. And also is the idea that there are things that we can't explain. There are things that happen that we don't know the bigger picture. We can't explain that they may seem like it's bad or good or whatever it is, but we don't know. And also with spirituality is another way is, what differentiates a human from a computer, right? It's that spirituality, that sense inside them that is different. That, and the human has a gut feeling often about things. That gut feeling is also spirituality. And think about people you connect with or friends that you have. That is a sense of spirituality that you can get along with this person more than you get with someone else, or you feel like you've known this person longer, even though you really haven't. So that's all things that can't be explained by what we normally would say. It's spirituality, in my opinion.
Yeah. And, the thing, the idea of just because you don't see it, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. When I think about, a dog's increased sense of smell or the ability of certain animals to see in different spectrums of light than we do, that it's just, there is so much more that exists beyond what our senses pick up. I know that is, as far as, when I took my psychology classes in college, spirituality wasn't one of those things that we talked about at all, and it was like, okay. But I'm glad to see that, as science progresses and is able to measure to a degree, some of the old traditions of of Buddhism or Hinduism, meditation, the actual bodily effects that meditation, can create. As we're going through and being able to better measure, that aspect, then I think we're going to be it's going to gain more acceptance in the general public.
Right.
Yeah. So now, one of the elements that you indicated is also humility. And, you know, when I look around, you know, there's, I mean, there are good examples of people who are humble, but it also seems to me that there is a heck of a lot more that aren't, you know, that don't exhibit that element. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, humility, you know, and the fact? Yeah.
I feel like being humble nowadays, especially with social media and the internet and the focus on glitz and glamour and wealth, is really important. The Buddha talks about this a lot, and I feel like humility is a way to connect with those people. It's lacking ego and pride, and also having a depth and a character, a confidence about you, and a sense that you don't need to feel big, and you don't want to make someone else feel small. You don't want to do that, because, you know, and if someone is not humble, I feel like they do feel better if they bring someone else down, if they make them feel small, and that just makes me wonder, like, what kind of person is that? So I feel like humility is actually really a lost art, and it's something that's very important.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's one of those things where I think, you know, that, like you said, with technology and the, you know, social media pressures like that, it can, I mean, that is highly focused on the ego. So, you know, and, you know, so that, in itself, then, you know, can, you know, take away from one's humility. Now, another one, like humility, that also seems to be, we're needing more of, is tolerance, you know. And boy, you know, with the world being so divided, it seems to me that, you know, there's a lot more intolerance than I seem to remember.
I feel like there is, and when I think of tolerance, I think of, you know, a lot of people have lost the ability to keep an open mind. And they've also they're ready to categorize. If someone does X wrong, they're ready to throw out the baby with the bathwater. And they're not really open to looking at the gray. And with tolerance, it's really looking at that gray part, being open to, you know, both sides of a story, and really keeping an open mind and asking questions of why, what, when, like asking all those questions and being genuinely curious about, and this is why I say they're related, but genuinely curious about a topic. And
And you know, and like with social media, you know, there becomes, if one expresses an interest in a particular viewpoint, then the algorithm then feeds them more of that same viewpoint. So so they're exposed less and less to alternative points of view.
True. So, yeah. Social media is causing more intolerance.
Yeah, I agree. We're kind of running low on time, so I want to just kind of quickly, the last two elements are creativity and curiosity. You mentioned curiosity, you know, just a second ago, you know, that is something that is also dampened, you know, with the way that, you know, we kind of find our little pigeonhole and stay in it. But creativity, you know, how does, you know, creativity kind of fit in with the idea of wisdom?
So I think both of them actually go back to what we innately have. We're innately, if you think about kids, we're innately creative and we're innately curious. Mm. And if we're stuck in the house with the chair, we'll turn the chair into something. Like, we just think as kids of things that you were not as adults. And so creativity and curiosity is something we genuinely have. And they both allow for someone to connect with someone else. Because you're thinking outside the box. And creativity is so important in that when you entertain different ideas or you brainstorm ideas, that's being creative. And curious is kind of looking at the future or looking at what can be. It's having an imagination. And something that you may not have. One thing we did find with creativity is people were also very creative with the life they lived. They didn't just wear one hat. They kind of wore many different hats of one, you know, they were this, they were that, they were this. They just enjoyed different parts of life in different perspectives. Mm. So they were creative not only and what they said was important to them, but they were also creative in how they lived their lives. So I think, and so creativity is not just what we think of as art or being artistic. Mm. And I think with creativity, it's really everything a person does can be creative. Everything from the way you make a food, from the way you dress, from whatever style you take. It's creative to who you are. And it's innate. Both of them, creativity and curiosity, are very innate. They're innate qualities that we all possess.
Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, those two qualities, like you mentioned, are, you know, very observable in children. Sometimes, you know, those are two qualities that tend to be quashed, you know. I mean, the idea of, you know, a child's, you know, invisible friends or even, you know, the fact that they're gonna, you know, they're fighting with, you know, a stick that's a sword or, you know, those kinds of things, you know, they're like, okay, come on now, stop playing around, you know, let's get back to this. And then, you know, again, in curiosity, you know, the idea of, you know, why, you know. And of course, I've been around children that there is that period, you know, of why. And then, you know, the parents like, oh, come on, stop asking, you know. And, you know, that in itself can kind of, you know, even though a child will hopefully, you know, disregard that, but it can, you know, put a little bit of a damper on those qualities that are really important.
And so that's kind of like that's why you want to be cognizant of the fact that with age, with the responsibility, it may squash your creativity and curiosity, but it shouldn't do too much of that. It should still, you should still have a healthy amount of both, because that, at the end of the day, we are kids. Inside a bigger body with more responsibilities. So I think it's important for us to realize that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Laura, this has really been a wonderful conversation. I really want to thank you. What do you hope that the readers will take away from reading Common Wisdom?
I definitely feel like I think the idea of wisdom is not sexy. And no one really pursues it. So I want them, when they read this book, to be like, wait, let me think twice about X. Let me think about how I can change my life. So what I want, and I've said this over and over again, is I'm not here to sell lots of books. I'm here for people to feel like their life has changed, to make a meaningful impact. And that's what I want them to get out of it. Is be like, wait, to read, to have a different lens.
Yeah. That, you know, that, and that's, I think your book accomplishes that with with your apt description of the elements, and then also the things to ask yourself at the back of each of those. Those are really good, kind of attention getters, and it can cause reflection. So it's really great. So I thank you for your time, Dr. Laura.
It's been wonderful. Thank you for reading it, and it was great talking to you.
Great. You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Dr. Laura Gabayan, and we've been talking about her new book, Common Wisdom. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is lauragabayan.com, and that's lauragabayan.com. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to BikeRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. To become a show follower, visit www.blogtalkradio.me and click on the follow link. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at BikeRadioMe. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.